I am ready. Matt, okay. do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah. My name is Matt Nastos, and I am a writer for film, for television, novels, comic books. I've done some video game work.
Yeah, anywhere there is stripping. Things, you have written things for. It's pretty nuts.
I've done a lot of different stuff. Let's see, I've written comic books, like I said. I'm writing the new Elf Lord.
Elf Lord? What's that?
Elf Lord is it's a comic that's been around since the 70s. It went from the 70s to the early, I guess, 2000s. What is the official word for the 2000s? Is that the new millennium? I mean,
Now I've got ideas. People don't usually like mine. I'm upset that we didn't take the chance to say aught. Because you could have said aught, you could have said, you know, 2006, that was totally appropriate.
Then I will say it ran until the early aughts.
You made me very happy.
Yes, and it was created by a guy called Barry Blair. He started a company called Aircell Comics back in the early 80s, and we're bringing it back. Barry was a mentor of mine, and we were working on bringing the book back in about 2000.
Yeah, you were
2010, and he passed away.
Well, you were working with him closely. You were sort of supposed to be the next line of Elf Lord before all of this happened, right?
Yeah. He was. He wanted me to write the book, and then he was going to do layouts. Barry was really fast. He could basically lay out an entire comic in about a day, and he liked the way I did finishes over his work. So we were going to kind of split up the chores. I was going to write and do finishes, and he was going to lay it out.
That's incredibly fast. I don't know how many people know about, like, the workflow stuff, but essentially, you're talking about him, like, in terms of other people understanding, like, storyboarding a half-an-hour movie, like, in a day. That's pretty much the work he was doing. That's insane.
Yeah, he was really fast. When he was at his height, he was doing, I think, about 10 or 12 books a month. He was responsible for most of Malibu's income back in the early 90s, and his work allowed them to buy all the computers that Marvel eventually bought them for. And his comics allowed them to distribute Image in the early days.
He's incredible, and the part that I love about it, and I don't know how much you want to talk about just writing with this, but I mean, his style. We were everybody at Our Hero Comic because we're going to do a radio version of the first episode, and I bought the first one because that was the only one available, and we were just covering up the thing we were doing was just covering up parts of the book and being like, well, what type of comic is that from? And we were like, and then we'd be like, okay, and then we would move our hands slightly and be like, oh, but this is a totally different comic over here. But then when it wasn't jarring, you would move back and it'd be like, everything works together. Like, this thing looks like it's from Yu Yu Hakusho, and this guy looks like it's from Fern Gully, but then this one's like from a Hitchhiker's Guide fan art. And it was amazing to us.
He grew up overseas. He grew up in Singapore and Hong Kong, and then his family relocated to Canada. And so he was exposed back in the late 60s, early 70s to a lot of Asian comics, you know, manga and it's the various versions in China and Taiwan and things like that. So he brought a lot of that, but he was also interested in like Mike Ploog and Wally Wood from the U.S. And you also find a lot of, later on, a lot of European influence. So his style was a real crazy mix of stuff.
Can we talk about writing? Because I got a chance. I don't have a Nook, but I got a chance to read a big chunk of Korra. It's like actually open on my desktop right now because I don't have a Nook, and I'm so afraid that if I close it, I will lose it. You know, we do a podcast about Tinder, and we do a podcast that's set in the future, and we do a podcast where we watch a TV show and play a drinking game.
I'm playing a drinking game right now. Every time a word with a vowel comes up, I take a shot.
Yeah, I play that one too. It's good after breakups. I love this Korra. First of all, the non sequitur is like, I love the natural speech kind of thing. You're so into the narrator that it's like, well, I'm thinking of this thing and then bam, over here. And I often, when I write things, I'm not as good as a writer of, you know, actual written word as opposed to film and stuff like that. People feel it's too much like talking, but I love you're a lot better at it, and it's so natural and it works that she's thinking about one thing and then we flip to something else. Like, it's a really great sort of style of writing that I clicked with right away. But the part I really loved was I have allergies too. And I love this idea that, like, really, like, you think about trees and you think about this stuff. Every allergy season, the trees are trying to kill me.
Yes.
And I get upset when people talk about sci-fi where, you know, it has to be so technical and it becomes about, like, real science when people, like, those articles you see where it's like, well, Batman couldn't actually fly with this thing and they have all these weird explanations for superpowers. But it's like, the point of sci-fi is to deal with the emotion of these wrong facts. It's like...
Right. I think once you lose track of the humanity, it's basically just a textbook.
Right. It's just a list of, like, what if octopuses were doctors? What if... Yeah. That's not real fiction. It's pretty exciting, this library, too, of all this stuff that you guys are coming out with. Because, I mean, I'll be honest. I went... You know, when you want to talk business and just emotional comic wise and literary fan wise, I went to every comic book store in New York City, and I was like, where can I find this stuff? And so, from a business point of view, it's smart too. But it's also like, how is it that I can go to every single backlog place in New York City and not find a single issue of this? It's something that, you know, has to be done. Has there been some sort of, you know, obviously the answer is yes, but to what extent has this been emotional for you guys to try and you know, it's a fitting tribute for Barry in both continuing his work and bringing it to the forefront? How has that been for you guys in doing that?
For me, I mean, it's been great just because Barry was the guy. I had been working at DC under a man named Joe Orlando as his assistant. Back in, I guess, about 92, 93. And Barry is the one that gave me my first real comic book work outside of that. So he hired me away from DC. And I had already been a fan of his work. And I was a huge fan of Wendy Pini's work on ElfQuest. And so getting a chance to work with him and the Pini's on ElfQuest was crazy. So I first met Barry almost 25 years ago. And, you know, we kept in touch all that time. And I was always a fan of his work. So getting a chance to continue something that I'm truly a fan of was fantastic. I mean, it's just awesome. You know, it's like if you're a Disney fan and all of a sudden you find yourself in a Disney movie, it's pretty much the same thing.
Are you worried at all about the fact that, I mean, I still read heavy metal. Obviously, there's always a fan base out there, but I was saying how there's a growing market for this era of comic books that Barry worked in. You know, Valiant has started printing again, and... But do you at all worry that the main people that we're seeing on the shelves are, you know, still superheroes? It's still a different type of sci-fi, that the fantasy comic book has sort of fallen out of favor a little bit?
Well, the fantasy stuff has always been a little more difficult in the direct market, just in general. I mean, always, except for, you know, a few of the licensed books like Conan lasted forever. ElfQuest did as well as it did because they went a lot outside of the direct market. And I've actually talked about this a ton of times, but the direct market itself is the Marvel and DC market. That's a sales channel that they built and they developed. Right. So any independent is going to have trouble there. Even Image isn't going to ever be able to do as well as those two, just because of the fact that it's a sales market that was, you know, developed and grown for Marvel and DC. It's, like I said, literally Marvel built it back in the late 70s. So the example I use is the direct market. It's kind of like going to McDonald's and trying to sell hamburgers in their parking lot. So anybody is going to have troubles. So what you have to do is you have to reach outside of that. And there's a huge fantasy fan base outside of comics. You know, you have, you know, things like Dungeons and Dragons, which is still insanely popular, and
right.
Fans of things like Game of Thrones and prose novels in general. There's a lot of openness to fantasy. And it's just going out there and finding those people and tapping that market and not really worrying as much about the direct market. And the direct market is great because I love comic book shops. I, you know, go to a comic book store two or three times a week. But for an independent comic, you have to go outside of that. And what's interesting is the audience is so much bigger once you leave the direct market.
Right.
So really it's just a matter of going outside of that direct market.
We get tricked sometimes in everyone that does in thinking that the thing that everyone is talking about is the thing that everyone's into, you know, just because it's the one that's in your face doesn't mean that it's the biggest one. Fantasy fans will bite with Dungeons and Dragons. I learned how to be a dungeon master recently, And it was so insanely difficult, but the prospect itself, just being put in front of me, I couldn't resist. I mean, there's no lack of hunger in that market, too.
Yeah, yeah, and they're pretty open. In general, I think they're a lot more open than comic book fans. Comic book fans tend to be kind of closed off and more influenced by, the comic book media. I'm not sure if there's a comic book media, but whatever that is. You know, they're easily influenced, they're easily outraged, they're easily swayed by, you know, what they see, you know, in the comic book sources. Yeah. And you'll see that online. You'll see it on Twitter. You'll see it on Bleeding Cool, various things like that. But the fantasy fans outside of that tend to be a lot more open and a lot more forgiving and accepting and all of that stuff, I think.
Hear, hear. I agree with that entirely. I mean, they when you – so many times when I meet a fantasy fan, when I meet a comic book fan, I can usually talk about whatever the latest, thing in DC is. But when I meet a fantasy fan, I rarely am reading the same thing they are or have just written, because they're just, you know, it is – they're open to everything. They are just, put the bait in front of me and I'll take it. There's no shortage of it, because that's not, part of it comes from this thing of like, it really is so far from our world that you're right to say it is part of sci-fi and fantasy are the same, because they are completely not our realm. They're based on a lie that's never going to happen where we live, whether it's magic or octopuses as doctors, you know, it's the same thing.
I think the difference between the two fan bases is kind of interesting. When you meet another comic book fan, it's almost adversarial, where you kind of say, oh, well, do you like this? Do you like this? Do you like this? You know, you're kind of judging them. For a fantasy fan, it's like, oh, you read that? How is that? I've heard that was really good. And, you know, it's a little bit different, I think.
Fantasy fans will accidentally read entire books before deciding they thought it was eh. You know, yeah, what I mean?
Sometimes two or three of those books.
I've done that.
Yeah, comic book fans are pretty sure it sucks before they open it.
Yeah, throw it away. I'll take one to burn. How do you see the future in, let's go 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years?
Oh, 50 years, I think we're going to be exactly the same as we are now.
Okay, I'm with you on that.
You know, I think even though technology has changed a lot, and we've had such a quantum leap over the past, 30 years or so. I mean, technology, just from when I was a kid, because I was born in 72, there was such a huge leap just between, 85 and 95, and then, or if you go 90 to 2000, such a huge leap, but people are still the same. They're dicks. And that's not going to ever really change. So, you know, I think you'll see a bigger gap in 1,000 years, you know, where hopefully we're out in space and doing fun stuff. So hopefully it turns into Babylon 5, because I like Babylon
5. Would you explore space if you had the chance?
Oh, yeah, totally. Because, see, I grew up in Hawaii, and I went to school in New York to get as far away from my family as possible. So if I can go out into space, that's even further. So I like that idea.
Well, Mom, I wish I could come over.
I'm 7 light years away, so I'm not going to be back.
I can try. Listen, I'm in that direction, which is, I like that a lot. I'm scared of space. I think that's so brave, anybody that goes and does that. I always thought as a kid, whenever I heard about colonialism, and this speaks to sci-fi, is like, I was like, okay, so they went on a boat. Like, that's not a big deal. And I think I've only now even hearing the horrors of it, I think only now do I really realize how scary being a colonist is when you think about space.
Well, and they had people that told them the Earth wasn't flat, but they weren't really sure yet. So it's like, yeah, let's go ahead and go and see what happens.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's round, the world's round, but you know, you go ahead and you do it and see.
Right, right. What's gonna happen in space?
It's
who knows?
Like the guy that first took milk out of a cow. I'm gonna drink whatever comes out of that hangy thing.
I always like to think of the cow on day two. You know what I mean? Day one, it was pretty shocking. Day two, he's like, all right, there's no way that guy's going to do that again. There's no... All right, here he comes. Barry did the Men in Black comic books as well. That was a part of Air Cell?
That was part of Air Cell. They didn't own it. He did a lot of creator-owned stuff for other people. So there were a few books that came in, and Air Cell was part of that. There was also a book that you may recognize the title. It was called The Walking Dead.
Oh,
a Walking Dead comic about a sheriff that hunted zombies. And I'm surprised that Robert Kirkman and those guys haven't been sued. or at least stopped or something, because there was that comic back in the late 80s, and it ran for a year or two, I think.
That's pretty nuts, too.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, like, when you go back and look at it, and I totally wish we had owned that one, but that was owned by, I think it was owned by a guy named Jim Somerville. And he should still have the rights to it, so I'm just not sure whatever, if he just decided it was too much trouble or what, but I'm greedy, so I would have gone after the money.
And the only reason I bring up Men in Black is just because it's very strange to me that it was, I mean, you talk about being an artist and not getting recognized. I mean, how much more needed to happen for Aircell to be something that, I mean, if I can find Valiant comics everywhere, like, I mean, Men in Black, that was a huge product. So I think you guys really are doing great work in trying, you know, you've all done amazing work aside from your careers with Barry, but it's a bit weird that, you know, it's every artist struggle to get noticed, but that's a bit strange that someone makes a multi-million dollar movie franchise about a comic book from your production company as a comic book publisher, and then you can't get those comics anywhere? I mean, it's pretty nuts.
Yeah, it's tough now. Now, that wasn't always the case, because back during the black and white boom in the 80s, Aircell was everywhere. And you could even find it, you know, into the 90s pretty easily. But a lot of that stuff, it just became harder and harder and harder over the years to get a hold of.
I really
Aircell did. Used to be everywhere. I mean, they were millions. I mean, they were probably the number three or four company. At one point, they were bigger than Dark Horse.
Oh, wow. I think this project's going to be really awesome. I was, in speaking of being greedy, I was really trying to get a copy of some Aircell comics, because I do think it's going to be successful, and I don't have a lot of valuable comic books in my collection, so I was hoping maybe I could get one and have something I could, you know, frame and tell people not to touch. Instead of the, but luck. Either way, I'm definitely going to be a customer, and it's going to be awesome.
Oh, nice! Well, if you get us your address, and we'll send you a bunch of the new stuff anyway.
Awesome! That would be amazing. Is there anything that we should because we're going to try and get bits of everybody's interviews that we're doing here on all my different podcasts? So, is there anything that how do I send them? What's the best way to send them to the Kickstarter? What should we say here?
Well, I guess the easiest way to get to the Kickstarter is to go to Kickstarter and type in Elflord. It should be the only thing that pops up. Or if you go to outlandentertainment.com, there should be links there. Or mattnastos.com. You know, there should be, you should be able to get right to all that stuff from any of those links.
Awesome.